This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'm joined by Riley Sussex and Sue Butler. Please welcome them. And it's emerged today that this term living language has kept coming up. And I just wanted to ask Sue about her role with words, and because it's been your life's work, Sue. How did you get into it, and what have you done?
Well, I got into it by sheer accident. I was actually setting out to be the great Australian composer, but I ran out of money. I had previously done an arts degree in Latin and Greek and a bit of linguistics and whatever, which equipped me to do absolutely nothing, but I did get one of the few remaining jobs teaching Latin, and then came back to do music. And I did music for a year and a half until I ran out of money, and I got all sorts of jobs to remedy this. I worked in a chocolate factory, but I had a toothache, and I worked in a belt factory, but I couldn't stand it. And so I ended up thinking, I'm a good middle-class girl, I'll get a nice middle-class job. And the job happened to be research assistant on a dictionary of Australian English.
And that was Macquarie?
That was Macquarie.
And that was the first Macquarie?
That was the first Macquarie. So that was about 1970, and we published the first edition in 1981.
And whose idea was it? The dictionary?
Well, I think it was an idea that had a number of different beginnings. I mean, there had been this search for a dictionary of Australian English among linguists, and so there were a group of people, Professor Delbridge, Dr. Ramson, John Bernard, David Blair, all of whom formed the, initial editorial committee of the dictionary. But equally, there was a publisher who had searched for a dictionary on the back of a whole program of educational publishing, literacy materials, teaching materials in the schools. A number of teachers had thought, it's about time we stopped teaching holly and snow and whatever, and started teaching gum trees and kookaburras and kangaroos and things. So they developed all this very Australian teaching material. Brian Plouston was an educational publisher who had one of these successful programs going. And he said that what he wanted was a dictionary to go with it. And basically he wanted something like, he wanted the Concise Oxford, but Australian. And so he sent an emissary down to, his editor claims he actually came up with the idea and was sent to talk to Professor Delbridge about doing this. So it was one of those ideas that had people in sort of different parts of the world all thinking about it, and they got it together amazingly.
Was it thought of as risky and ambitious, or was it something that the publisher was confident would work?
Well, I think Brian Clouston was confident because of the success of his reading programs, and Australiana Publishing had a big success then. However, he knew nothing about dictionaries, so he told Arthur to have it done in 2 years, and the 2 years was extended to three, and then Brian fell out and was sort of booted out of the publishing company, and so that was taken over by... So various things happened, and
we went
into the university as a sort of sheltered workshop while we sorted out all of this, and so a lot of things happened, so that by the time we got to 1980, still a strong feeling of national publishing and so on. But Oxford was very strong, and I think that it's hard to think back to that time and remember that before the Macquarie was published, it now seems, so secure, it was a very risky undertaking indeed. And I remember coming in to see Kevin Weldon, who was the publisher, sort of slamming the phone down and reaching for a glass of whiskey and saying, this dictionary better be as bloody good as you say it is, or else I'm absolutely done for. So it was risky. And then suddenly it was there, and we all held our breath and waited, and the response was fantastic.
And
it's been great.
Coincidentally, Manning Clark wrote the foreword.
That was another, nervous experience from my point of view, because here I am...
Because you had to meet Sebastian.
Here I am, a lowly little editor on this thing, this dictionary, and I can't even, in a way, explain what I'm talking about, because it's so hard to visualise before the event. But I tried to explain and to ask Manning Clark, great historian, to write the foreword to it. Would he do it? And we sat back and waited, and the answer came, yes, he did, and he did a very fine foreword for the first edition.
And Rolly, you've really got language in the blood.
Yeah, my father was a professor of French, and my university degrees were in French and Russian. And then I went to Prague to do a PhD. That was in 68, which was a bad year. And eventually, my Volkswagen and me and a lot of books managed to get out. I worked in Germany as a translator in a crystal factory for 3 months, working out. So this is parallel to a belt factory.
Okay.
Right? We have something else in
common. You know what I mean.
Yeah. I'm also a failed muso until I was going to be a clarinetist until I ruined an arm at school. I went to London, did a PhD in Russian and linguistics, and so I've been a linguist ever since. I had the chair of Russian at the University of Melbourne until 1989, and I was getting worried that Gorbachev was going to pull the whole thing down and I'd be left with no job, head of gardening or something. Now, I love gardening, but no. And UQ said, would I like to come and talk to them about a job in applied linguistics, and I've been there ever since. My involvement with English, and unlike Sue and Bruce, I'm not a lexicographer, but I'm certainly a lexicologist, a word freak, began really with the ABC. They rang up about 14 years ago and said, people are griping about the standard of public English. Would you like to come and do a program? And so I went down to the local ABC, and the phone lit up like a Christmas tree, and we've been going ever since. So every week I do three language talkback programs, one with Queensland, one with South Australia, one with the Territory. I was on Radio National last week with Richard Eady, and I write a column for the Courier Mail every Saturday on language. And we have an email list called Lang Talk, which runs behind all these, with about 80 people worldwide who are interested in language in Australia. If anyone's interested, get hold of me after, and I'll inscribe you all digitally. I'm busy doing a dictionary at the moment of diminutives, things like wino and dero and Huey and Hawkey and so on, about which we shall talk anon. And so I've become enormously interested in Australian English and proud of it, and love sloshing around in this great big soup that we're experiencing at the moment.
So the things that have emerged today is that the idea that language has life, and that there is some resistance to change but some acceptance of change. Your theme is that a living language is a changing language. It has to change to live.
Not only. I think also at the moment Australian English is distinguished by the fact that we've got multiple parallel streams of the language. There are not only different sorts of Australian English, but we're surrounded by various sorts of British English. Watch The Bill tonight and you'll see it. Canadian, New Zealand, South African. Any South Africans here? We can do South African now. Good, I won't insult you further. And as a result, instead of having a single model, as you have, say, in Russian or French, where the academy says, this is the language, this is our monument, and you will worship at it, and woe be to you if you actually destroy it or sully it. In Australian English, we are busy trying to find out where we are and where we're going. In France, after all, if a journalist uses an Anglo word where there is a Gallic word, they will be taken to court and fined.
Really?
Yes, really, and it has happened. Think of that in Australia. So we are the ultimate eclectics, if you like, but also the inheritors of an incredibly rich tradition. David said this morning that as soon as English becomes an international language, it's dead. It seems to be alive and kicking, actually. But one of the things Sue and I want to talk about is why it is kicking so well.
Well, let's take that up.
Okay, well, we have picked up on the theme of change. This is something that I encounter in my working life all the time. I also encounter the people who love it and the people who resist it. And it seems to me that in all aspects of life, we have this kind of balance between conservatives and optimists. The optimists greet the words that we put up on the website each year with cries of delight and say, oh, isn't that lovely enough? And that one's good fun. And that, yeah, oh, hadn't heard of that, but I can find a use for that somewhere. And the pessimists say, what are you doing introducing all this, you know, ruination into the language and so on. So somewhere between the two, we carry on doing this sort of thing. So along with change, there is also, we want to now introduce the notion of standards as they relate to change. And standards working with change, sometimes bumpily and sometimes quite well. So we're going to start with change in the pronunciation patterns in Australian English. We're picking up in a way on what Bruce said about dealing with pronunciation on one side and lexicon on the other. So Rowley will deal with pronunciation.
Oh, all right.
Over to you.
He will eventually.
Okay. One of the odd things about English is that the written language, or the written standards, if you like, are much more standard across different jurisdictions. And you might find, if you pick up a newspaper, that you're not sure whether it was written in Delhi or in Wellington or in Tokyo or wherever, with the exception of spelling and a few odd lexical uses. Whereas the spoken language, as we all know, is enormously varied and in many cases unstable. The standards of the Australian accent, Bruce talked about this early, were starting to emerge around about 1830. And although we don't have clear phonetic evidence until a bit later, it is obvious that we were distinct. But unfortunately, we don't have the New Zealand data that Bruce was talking about. We can work out things about from early recordings about what Australian English sounded like. I've been listening to some early Melbourne Cups and the VFL Grand Final, and the standards of Australian spoken English in some ways have not changed as much as you might expect. What has happened, I think, is that an interesting thing noticed by Mitchell and Delbridge in their book on Australian pronunciation has shifted. Now, in 1970, their book said that there were basically three sorts. There was educated, about the top 11%, top in terms of social prestige and education. There was a big group called general Australian in the middle, about 56%, and then broad Australian. And that was possibly prompted a great deal by the experience of the soldiers in the trenches in First World War. Then there was ethnic English in Australia, and that covers a huge range of different accents, not only Aboriginal English, but also Greek English. Do you remember Con the Fruiterer?
Beautiful.
All right. And again, in different levels and flavours. What appears to have happened over the last few years is that we're converging towards a middle, that there are fewer speakers at the educated top end. In other words, fewer like Mr. Downer. But there are somewhat fewer also at the socially lower end. No, Jenny Mayle, I've been to the toilet three times this morning. That sort of thing is now less prevalent than it was. And we seem to be congealing in the middle towards a more standard accent, if you like. On the other hand, there are many important instabilities, part of which has to do with our exposure to American English. And I've got some lovely examples which I want to discuss with you in particular in relation to stress. Word stress has been a problem in Australian for years. I mean, do you say pittosporum or pittosporum, the gardeners among you? And do you say clematis or clematis? You hear both. But recently I picked up vaccination with the H rather than vaccination. Right? Paraplegic on the radio yesterday rather than paraplegic. And even Don Watson this morning said 16 rather than 16. Now, these things we don't really pay much attention to. And until you become sensitized, you may not be aware of it. I hope today that what I will do is to make you excessively sensitive, and you will provide me with thousands of examples. But what seems to be happening is that, first of all, stress is moving towards the front of words, which actually happened before in Middle English, by the way. Second, that there are a few words where the stress is moving away from the first syllable. And third, there are some examples where this is actually having an effect on the pronunciation of vowels. So let's have a look at those. First syllable in proper names. When I was a kid, it was Fiji, Mindanao. Now, by default, it's Fiji, Mindanao, first syllable. And Afghanistan, rather than Afghanistan, or arm. Pakistan, or Pakistan, rather than Pakistan. If you think a little bit, you'll realise that we've actually had a stress shift of quite substantial proportions. In Melbourne, poor old things, I can say that because I come from there, they don't know whether it's Turak or Turak, Fitzroy or Fitzroy. Right? And in Brisbane, there's a place called Mount Gravatt. Visitors from down the south, the Mexicans so-called, and they still number me among those, so although we've been there since 89, ask what's the way to Mount Gravatt. And the locals go, ha, 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 and it comes from Victoria. Now, this is interesting because we are moving the stress to the first syllable, not just where we're imitating the Americans who do have a tendency in that direction, but also in places where the Americans don't. Australians will tend to say Illinois, whereas the Americans, who know perfectly well that it was first written that way by French speakers, will say Illinois. Okay? Now, even more so probably with compound Latin-derived words with a prefix. Translation? No, translation. And there are, in fact, thousands of those around in the vocabulary. Also, move to the first syllable in phrases. When I was younger, the place where the American president lived was the White House. Now, quite clearly, it follows the American White House, where you treat adjective plus noun as a phrase, put the stress on the first element. I heard yesterday on the radio, garlic bread. Not garlic bread, but garlic bread. That was my kitchen rules. And they ought to know, by the way. And someone said that Solzhenitsyn's novel was not Cancer Ward, but Cancer Ward. A few, well, 20 years ago, I think, that sort of stress would have been regarded as emphatic. Nowadays, it is increasingly standard. The move of the stress, or rather problems with stress, are also found in words like, okay, here we go, French-derived ones like ballet and ballet. Probably the most interesting one in Australia is perfume and perfume. I actually went to Meijer one day, approaching Christmas, and said, what was the difference? And they said, oh, perfume is over $400 and perfume is under. Which tells you that the French-derived one, which is also the American one, by the way, has more prestige and therefore more dollars. There's a whole stack of these. They're typically American. They're all from French. And they all move the stress onto the last syllable. So ballet, baton, beret, bourgeois, rather than bourgeois, café, that could be Italian, I suppose, debris, rather than debris or débris, debout. By the way, that's the most awful word. What happens if you make it a verb and do a past tense? Yesterday he debuted? No one quite knows. Frontier, and for that matter, premiere. Garage, this one's funny, goes all over the place. But these ones, I think you'll agree, are among the pronunciations that we do hear some of in Australia. I have heard someone say, by the way, both research and research in the same sentence. So we are truly unstable and unsure where they're going. Americans will tend to say Renaissance rather than Renaissance. And I think, with a few exceptions, these ones are, no, they're a rather interesting group of words because they are a pattern where the stress is moving away from the first syllable for a very specific reason, and that is we appear to be imitating the Americans. Apart from that, American also is St. Augustine, rather than Augustine. I've heard that from native Australian speakers. If you have a dog, it's a St. Bernard, rather than a St. Bernard. Not to mention the philosopher Nietzsche, rather than Nietzsche, and Van Gogh, rather than Van Gogh or Van Gogh. So stress is actually having quite an interesting, unstable effect on our vocabulary. Got a few other examples, like regulatory and ceremony, and laboratory and mandatory and so on. This is a slightly different phenomenon. In American English, there is a smaller difference between stressed and unstressed syllables in terms of pitch, volume, and length than there is in particularly Australian and most particularly upper-class British English. So you can imagine, and I'm overdoing it, an aristocrat saying, oh, go to the secretary. Barely two syllables. Well, secretary in American is four. What happens in American English is that unstressed syllables have more prominence, and therefore the vowel is more fully realized, and over time this can even attract the stress, which is why in 2000 at the Olympics there was a mandate out that Australian broadcasters would kindly say ceremony, and NBC in the next booth was saying ceremony. And I'm afraid at the last Olympics we've had a great vacillation, the Winter Olympics included, between ceremony and ceremony. And among younger people, ceremony is on the up. Different. The R at thing is educated British and South Australia versus the rest. If you come from South Australia, you probably say dance in Alexander. If you come from elsewhere, you probably say dance in Alexander. Newcastle is Newcastle in New South Wales and South Australia, but it's Newcastle everywhere else. And the A pronunciation is typical of British outside of the southeastern counties. More examples. Ordinarily, now this is interesting because if you get something which is has a simpler other form, that stress will tend to dominate. So console gives you inconsolable rather than inconsolable. Demonstrably gives you demonstrably. And I think, yes, comparably rather than comparably. Some of you are looking really ill. I'm sorry. Irrevocably rather than irrevocably. You can see what's happening. That we are, in fact, getting away from patterns where there was a difference of stress between the issue like the verb and the derived word, and they're tending to normalize into just one pattern. A few others while I'm on the subject of pronunciation. A y is in trouble, the y sound. Acupuncture or acupuncture? You'll probably hear acupuncture more than the other one. Revolution or revolution? Resolution or resolution? After all, suit has long become suit. Right, that's okay, that's gone. But I actually heard David Malouf this morning say nuance. No, he said nuance, I beg your pardon, the American way. And how many of you are nude people as opposed to nude people? No, sorry, I won't ask that, it's too embarrassing. But what about revolution and revolution? Right? The year is weird. I hear quite often foliage rather than foliage in the gardening programs. Palliative becomes palliative. And value becomes value. Year, value. Australia is Australia, in the speech of Pauline Hanson, who has recently left these shores. Million becomes million. Right? Now listen, what's happening here is that you've got two consonants, the second one wins. So that million, L is the end of one syllable, Y is the start of the next one, the second one wins, so million becomes million. It's interesting, isn't it? It's moderately systematic, and I think it's getting further. Y plus a dental, like S, well, tissue is already, I think, British and rather affected in Australia. Everyone says tissue, except for very, very careful speakers. But what about nuclear fission? That's a hypercorrection. I once heard Mr. Peacock say that. I'm not quite sure if he was having a bad day or not. But what about assume? And mostly that's assume. And consumers? Right? Whereas careful speakers and the more British ones assume. I've even heard assume recently. And that, of course, is doing the American thing of getting rid of the year.
Rolly, if you want to hear pronunciation butchered, you need to listen to a few horse races.
Oh, yes.
Because recently I heard a Grace Corlock talk of a horse called Sword of Damocles. And Antipodine. I kid you not, sorry.
He's got the good lines, hasn't he? All right. Just a couple more, which actually don't have to do with Americanisms. You'll hear quite often terrorism rather than terrorism, and library rather than library, deteriorate rather than deteriorate, and regularly and itinerary. Now, what's happening here is particularly with R, is that the English R is retroflex, which means that it's made with the tongue up and back. And that is actually a most unusual position for R in the languages of the world. Usually it's R, like Italian, which is dead easy, or it's R as in French, which is no problem at all, as long as you're French. But if you're going to get your tongue into the retroflex position in adjacent syllables, then you've got to work quite hard. And the tendency at speed is to leave one syllable out. And so terrorism becomes terrorism. Once again, it shows you how in even not uncareful speech, that differences and parallel standards are starting to emerge around us. We haven't yet got to nuclear. That's an Americanism. Thanks be to George W. But actually, he's not the first American president to do that. Eisenhower said it at least once, and so did Clinton. They must have trouble. There are two words that go cular. The other one is cochlear. Remember the cochlear implant? All of the other ones go clear, like nuclear and so on. And therefore, nuclear is following a pattern. So, the sounds of Australian English are in some kind of ferment. Some people say we're becoming more like the New Zealanders. No. Felicity Cox at Macquarie has good data to say that we are not. We do not have fush and chups. Are there any Kiwis here, by the way? May I? All right. A Kiwi got up on Auckland Harbour Ridge with a huge paintbrush and wrote, "Australia sucks." And someone from Australia got up the next day and wrote New Zealand nil.
Yes.
But counter to the view that the English of the world are converging, New Zealand is going off on its own. Not only that, they have when you're sleepy, you go to bid rather than to bed, which does not mean you're going to the TAB. And there's the Alexander becomes Alexander, which is found in Australia as well. If you ask for someone's celery, you're not sure if you're vegetables or money. Think about it. You'll hear more than you think. On the other hand, in New Zealand, clean air is what you have after a bath or what you breathe. And in fact, ear and air are falling together. That means that some Englishes are maintaining their distinction. And for my money, Australian English is doing at least as well by sounding distinctively Australian. Thank you. So.
Okay, well, having confronted what's happening to Australian English pronunciation, I'm now going to talk about what has happened to the words of Australian English, the things that I put in the dictionary or the dictionary or the dictionary. Yes. the Europeans who arrived had in front of them a whole new terrain, a whole new landscape. They had to find words to deal with this, and so they did it in the sort of accepted ways in which English expands and copes with these situations. So they borrowed from the local languages. For example, kangaroo, Captain Cook's journal. One of the men saw an animal something less than a greyhound. It was of a mouse colour, very slender, maiden, swift and foot, called by the natives kangaroo. And so we acquired a certain number of words from Aboriginal languages in that way. The other way of coping with the situation was to take words that were part of your common store and apply them, adapt them to deal with the new situation. So something like a paddock, which in British English was a small field or enclosure, becomes the Australian paddock, which can be as large as a small country. We also borrowed from American English, bushranger, which we think of as being entirely our own thing. I think it started out in American English and meant there what we think of as being a bushman. It was a frontiersman, someone who travelled through the bush, lived in the bush. We did a hell of a lot more with bushranger than the Americans did. They kind of dropped it. So I think we can probably claim it now as being definitely Australian English. A creek in British English was a stream, was a little inlet or arm of the sea, whereas in Australian English it becomes part of that hierarchy of waterways. A creek, whether it has water in it or not, whether it's small or big or, you know, twice the size of your nearby river, is a creek because it flows into a river and the river flows into the larger water. So we took these terms from British English and adapted them. And then we formed new compounds by taking words, usually one word which was significant, like bush, and applying it to, attaching it to other words to create a compound that was something more, something different than just the sum of its parts. So you get the bush ballad, the bush biscuit, the bush blanket, the bush carpenter, the bush cook, bush costume, dress, bush duty, bush experience, and on it goes. Different Englishes do this sort of thing. I mean, in Singaporean Malaysian English, it's a word like temple that becomes that significant word or dragon attaches a whole lot of words to it that become compounds with their own specific meaning. So that's the basic procedure for expanding the vocabulary to cope with the situation. And what I thought I'd do is take you on a little gallop through the lexicon of Australian English, what we might think of as the traditional lexicon of Australian English, and then fetch up with where we're at the moment. So we start with convict terms, and you have the traps for the police, and a plant for a cache of stores, something that you put somewhere for later. New chums and old chums are convict terms from the hulks, which come out to the colony, become terms for new people who have been in there for a while or people who've just come off the boat. I don't know that we talk about old chums so much, but we certainly talk about new chums. You know, the office new chum has got to be shown around. So
just on that later, didn't you mean to say for Ron? You always had some for Ron, for later Ron?
Thank you, no, yes, sorry. Of course I did, yes.
no one's ever heard it.
We acquired pastoral terms like bush, scrub, creek, paddocks, squatters, rosellas, cocky farmers, mates, coves, and so on. Rosella is one of those words that you might think of as being an Aboriginal borrowing, but it isn't. It comes from Rose Hill. It's the bird they saw at Rose Hill, and it became a rosella, a bit of a trap.
Did you get rosellas on?
The park?
The plant.
Oh, the plant. Bruce, the rosella, there's a transfer. British transfer. There you go.
They are racing at Rose Hill this afternoon, by the way. If anyone's got earlier results, just pass them on.
Aboriginal borrowings like billabong, brolga, jarrah, kangaroo, mallee, kookaburra, wombat and budgerigar. And once budgerigar gets shortened to budgie, everyone forgets that it's actually from something that sounds like an Aboriginal borrowing. From the goldfields, we had fossick. I love that word, fossick. And diggers and billies and hatters, eccentric miners and bushmen they were. And shepherding a claim, which is nice because it transfers to football, where you shepherd the person who holds the ball. You get bush ballad, moving on to sort of 1890s, early 1900s, things like the interest in the bush, romantic notions of the bush and the bush ballad, and produces a certain number of words as well. Bludgers, wowsers, and a lurk. World War One, diggers, bonzer, cobber, furphy, for that story that you don't entirely believe. Furphy's another one I really like, and it seems to be surviving. And the brass razoo. Then the Depression, the bottler, the sleep out, the susso, World War II, emu parade, giggle suit, fatigue suit, milk run, troppo for going slightly crazy, a galah for a fool, and spine bashing. I do wish we could keep spine bashing. It's a lovely word, but it doesn't seem to be hanging around much longer. Spine bashing, having a rest, lying down, sleeping. So that takes us up to the Second World War, and then things started to be very different indeed. So we had this influx of American English. We had the pace of life changing, a whole lot of technology. I remember, you know, the 80s, where you've the first time you had the PC on your desk, and we learnt about things being user-friendly, and everyone thought that was great fun. So I had citations for a fridge being described as user-friendly, and then a car door being described as user vicious. It was nice. We played around with that sort of stuff. So that kind of progress of the mix of IT, slang, fashion, American English and so on results in the new words in the fifth edition, where you have new sports. We seem to be inventing new sports so fast these days. Adventure running, and you have an adventure race. An attack ad, a baby daddy, your besties, your best friends, boyzillion wax, car crash TV, clothing swap party, connoisseur tourism, well, there's been a whole spate of tourisms, cowboy boots for fashion, crunk cup, deceptive marketing, divorce jeans, gauging, that's right. E-book readers, iconocrats, electronic whiteboards, ethical shopping, film tourism, folksonomy, forfeiting, freakonomics, future-proofing things, and so on. So those words seem incredibly different from the sorts of words that we regard as being traditional Australian English. And that's the kind of influx of new words that we're dealing with. If I do a similar quick gallop through slang in Australian English, you get convict slang of a lark, feeling, being queer, being unwell, shaking someone down, doing something on the sly, snitching on someone, snoozing for sleeping, which was interesting, a steak for booty, a swag, a swell, a toddler, turning up trumps, and spinning a yarn, and your whack for your share. And also kid for a young thief, which is, I'm sure, where we got that message that was sent to us by all our teachers and parents, that you mustn't talk about kids. Kids are young goats. You mustn't talk about kids, you're not going down to the street to play with the other kids. They're the other children, not the young goats. And I'm sure it was because kid had this unfortunate, you know, sort of connotation. And they didn't want to be implying that the neighbour's children were in some way involved in sort of thieving activity. Anyway, for better or worse, these words that came in with convict jargon, slang, are still really colloquialisms in Australian English. It's as if, even though we've forgotten completely, you know, where they came from, and yet there is this sense that they are in they're never to be granted complete respectability. They'll always be in that kind of fringe area of Australian English. After that, we had the British hand-me-downs, the language of London. Throughout the late 1800s, London was the centre of the universe, as America probably is now. And so we followed all those fashions in London and picked up as soon as we could on what was the latest thing to say. And we brought with us a certain amount of dialect that became slang in Australian English. So we have flummoxing to astonish people, a fluke, have a geek at something, give someone jip, joshing someone, a Molly Duker for a left-hander and a Molly Grubber for the low ball in cricket, Rafferty's rules, taking a punt, the Rozzers, Shavoo, Skerrick, Slummicky, Smidgen, Smooging, Little Tackers and so on. That takes us, I'm going to leap from there to, again, post-Second World War and what we're dealing with now. And now we're dealing, as I said, with being besties with someone, about someone being the man, about saying duh when you used to be insulting to someone, about saying your mum when you wish to be insulting to someone. You know that one? You know, it's sort of a shortened version of your mum's a something or other. And so you don't bother to expand at all, you just say your mum. And this implies complete derision of what was said before. So you can see the progression in lexicon and how life has changed in Australian English. I don't think, if you're a language optimist, you say, yes, well, this is what it's all about and this is us moving on. If you're a language pessimist, you're a bit scared. It's one of the funny things about change. We view it in different ways depending on how distant, how removed we are from the change. So at this point, I'd like to invite Bruce to give us the first lines of Canterbury Tales, being our medieval expert in our midst. I sprung this on him, so.
The medieval days are a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that working?
Yeah.
Okay, if you remember the first lines of the Canterbury Tales, it's about the coming of spring, and Chaucer saying, well, when spring comes, of course we all go on pilgrimages, or pilgrimages. And it goes, Juan de April with his shoulders salter, the drocht of March hath persed to the rota, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendred is the floor. Juan Zephyrus, eke with his sweat of breath, inspired hath in every holt and earth the tondra cruppers, and the younger son, and that's about as far as I can. That's 30 years ago.
Thank you, Bruce.
Can I just move to the Northern Territory in 2006 by comparison? And I got an invitation from Chief Minister or something, being a territory, and it had on it what we were to wear to the function, and it said territory rig, which is, so I rang up the office and said, what is this territory rig? And the woman said, anything you like, mate.
There was a segue there, but I was still looking for it.
Well, what I wanted to point out, as Bruce has eloquently done, is that that doesn't sound very much like modern English. And there's lots of words in there we don't use anymore. But do we mind? No. We say, hey, you know, that's cool. That's fantastic, Bruce. Do it again. You know, that's great. So change as long as it's far enough away, is fine. Well, we think it's delightful, interesting, entertaining. It's change in our own lifetime that really rattles us, because we all, as I think we've said somewhere today, that we're experts on language. But the truth of the matter is we're experts on our own language. We make our own language choices, and we know them, and we love them, and we can explain them to the world. And we kind of assume that everyone else has made the same language choices that we've made. And every now and then we come up against the fact that someone has made a choice that's slightly different. And this is difficult. And the older we get, the more often we see that people are making choices that are different from ours. And it gives you an uneasy feeling to see your rock-solid view of your own English and your shared English being shaken up so fundamentally in that way.
So what does a word need to do to get into the dictionary?
A lot of people ask that question. And sometimes they ask it with a kind of glint in their eye. I don't know quite what the fascination is. They sort of think, oh, it suddenly occurs to them, I can get one past her and get it into the dictionary, and that'll be my word that I've snuck into the dictionary. I suppose it's something to do with the authority of the dictionary. And if you can get a word in there, then that's pretty impressive. But it is, as again someone said earlier, the democracy of numbers, democracy of use in the community. If I can find sufficient evidence that people actually use this word meaningfully, that it's not just a personal word, a family word, I can give it to you and expect to be understood, and we can carry on our conversation without little aside saying what I mean by that is da-da-da-da, then this is a word that has common currency. It might only be in a section of the community, not necessarily the whole community. The skateboarding community might understand very well some of the words that they use and not have to explain things as they go along, although they might to the rest of us. So basically you find that evidence, if the evidence is there, you can put the word in. Now, I think that gets us... having done with pronunciation and the lexicon, we go to...
Diminutives.
Yeah.
I've just got 2 minutes on diminutives. These are forms like wino and dero and hawky and bossy and leper and so on. I'm finishing a long-awaited dictionary of about 5,000 of these things. And given that the Macquarie's core is 112,000, mm-hmm. approximately, that's rather a lot. There are more than 24 ways to form these things, and Australian English beats the rest of the world by a country mile. The Scots have quite a few, the New Zealanders some, the South Africans some, like Baccy, for example. But we are the winners. Have you been to Rocky recently on your Beamer? Rockhampton on your BMW? We do it for place names all over the place, like Bundy for Bundaberg, and Smelbourne for Melbourne, but we won't go there. I haven't had the pledge, meaning the pleasure. And there are lots of forms like, well, if you go to the wine shop and ask for some Cab Sav. Yeah. If you say Cabernet Sauvignon, they'll offer you something worth $120. You know? Cab Sav, it's a way in which you, if you like, mark your belonging to a group of people who know about wine. And so you get a Gewürz, which is actually Gewürztraminer. A Chardy and a Sem and a Treb. Some of these you will recognize, others you might think about a little bit first. Hey, mate, there's a Mozzie on your Cozzy. Some we get from the Americans. If you've been building your body recently, you've been conscious of your carbs, and you're trying to build your abs, your glutes, your quads, your biceps, and your tris. After which you'll have a six-pack. Good luck. We do it to politicians if we like them. Hawke, it was Bob Hawke while he was popular. He's no longer known as Hawke. But Wayne Goss left when he was in front. He's still Gossy. We do it to football people endemically. So Dipier Domenico, if your name is long, shorten it. Dipper. Jezelenko is Jezza. If you happen to support the Brisbane Lions, you'd know about Vossi and Brownie and Leper. And if you happen to support the Broncos, and I hope they won this afternoon, Lazar is Glenn Lazarus. By the way, one of my favourite ones here is not a diminutive at all. There was a man who was called Bunnings as a nickname, and they asked why he was called Bunnings, and he said, well, what does Bunnings do? His name is Sell Wood.
Very good.
You go to the veggie shop and you buy Kiwis and Mandy's and Rockies and Grannies and Johnnies and Collies. We do this. If your name ends in an R after the first syllable, it turns into a Z. Barry becomes Bazza. Mary becomes Mezza. Sharon becomes Shazza. Murray becomes Muzza. There's a stack of theirs as well. And I could go on with a lovely recitation for many hours, but it shows you that this is not only very productive, and there are new ones turning up as new people enter the sporting arena, and in addition, they are used frequently in everyday speech. They're part of the way we indicate, if you like, belonging to an Australian community of speakers, and so they're regarded as solidaristic. You will hear Australians overseas using these more than is humanly possible because they want to say, in this place, I want everybody to know where I come from. Sue.
Okay. Having talked about all of that, we're going to move on now and talk about the protectors of standards. Standards and what they are. No, actually, Rolly, you were going to talk about standards first of all, different varieties of Australian English,
okay,
which you mentioned before.
And prestige forms, and standards. Prestige is terribly important because it's the sort of English that people, well, the sort of language that people like to imitate if they want to achieve the status of the people who are powerful and in positions that they want to aspire to. And so, you know, the form of French which won was not the French of Avignon, which might have become the national standard. It was the French of Paris, because that was the place where religious, royal, mercantile and other power was concentrated. Likewise, London, for English. In Australia, we have a real problem with what the prestige model is and how we identify it and what we do about it. I was born in Melbourne. I lived here till I was 10. We then went to live in New Zealand for 12 years. I came back in 74. And before I left, the news was read on the ABC by people with British accents. And Current Affairs was British. Remember Movie Tone News? Yeah. And how many of you were Argonauts? Any? Yay! A good generation. All of this was cast in a very different sort of English from the English we used in the playground or behind the shelter sheds or when playing football. And we were quite clear that Australian and English was what we identified with, but the other one was the one that we tended to use if we wanted to get a job. And in fact, there was a distinct shift. I remember that John Bernard went out looking for speakers of broad Australian English, and he found some in Western Sydney. He brought them to his lab, put them in front of a microphone, and miraculously they'd gone up a notch to general Australian English. He couldn't get them to speak broad Australian English at all. And so we had this love-hate relationship with our own variety. When I came back in 74, Graham Kennedy was in full flood, together with the dog Rover, and I use the word flood advisedly. Do you remember that? All right. Interestingly, by the way, Sydney wouldn't take Melbourne programming, and so they had Don Lane, an American. But Australian English had arrived, and we get educated Australian accents universally through the media in all of the prestige slots where they'd been before. People like... who was it? Sorry, missed that one. Nowadays, though, I occasionally ask on the radio, what do my listeners think the best speakers of English in Australia are? Not necessarily best Australian English, which is a slightly different question. Almost to a person, they give us female broadcasters on ABC and SBS. Maxine McHugh, rather, former broadcasters. Maxine McHugh, Carolyn Jones, Mary Costakidis, Jennifer Byrne, Li Lin Chin, who's Hong Kong Chinese, of course, Juanita Phillips. Some people say hoax, but I think they're pulling my leg. But it's really interesting that they're mainly female. A few male voices. Gough Whitlam is a devastatingly fluent speaker. Sir James Killen was a speaker of great elegance, whose passing I regret. But it's interesting that, I mean, a lot of my foreign students ask me, whom should I imitate? Difficult question. Really difficult question. You listen to Triple J or football commentaries or the Melbourne Cup or wherever the racing happens to be on, you won't hear that sort of English. And yet it's the sort of English with which we also identify. And therefore, the dictionary maker has a real problem of which pronunciation or how many pronunciations to not only mention but also to license, and what sort of things are going to constitute the sort of, if you like, kosher Australian English that we should be regarding as the one which we want to purvey to the world. Larrikin people like Roy and HG are part of it. I think bush poets are part of it. We have a very wide span, which has now become our English, and the prestige, different sorts of prestige, are associated with different sorts of speakers in different contexts.
Just got to watch the time a little bit. But okay. 5 minutes left. Do you want to take questions, or you've got something else to mention?
Well, maybe I'll have to pick up on this. I was going to do usage standards and so on, but maybe
why don't you? That's good.
Okay. Just 5 minutes on that, and then we'll see what we can do. The standards, the people who protected our standards used to be not here but over there. We used to get all our advice on what was right in English from British English. So it's a great step forward that we're now actually writing those, making those decisions ourselves and voicing those decisions in the dictionary, usage notes, in our own writing guides, style guides, and so on. So that's great. However, I do find in the dictionary I struggle with how to word the note that you write for an entry like agreeance, for example. I'm in agreeance with you. Now, there are a lot of people who would say that that's not proper English. And yet there are some highly educated people. It's common when you go to say, oh, well, it's educated usage versus... it's not true. Educated usage, agreeance is fine. And so you say, well, agreeance is this word. It's used commonly, but there are some people in the community who will get upset by it. And who these some people are, it's very hard to pin down and hard to describe them. And so even if we do have, we're making our own decisions, it's hard to know who's making the decisions and how far those decisions go. To be bored with, the construction bored of, as in bored of his studies, is increasing in frequency. Bored with would be considered correct, but the analogy with tired of is proving to be overwhelming. And it, you know, bored of is now just so common that people cease to remark on it. So it's very hard to know, particularly where you have things which are in a state of flux, who you side with. Do you side with that little group of... So at their worst, they're pedants. At their best, they're enlightened, educated users of the language wishing to protect and maintain its beauty. But then over there, you've got enlightened speakers, eloquent, articulate people who are using these constructions. And the only thing, I think, from the dictionary point of view, I can definitely say is a marker of non-prestige Australian English is the use of use. Everyone who writes to the dictionary says, you've put use in the dictionary. And we say, yes, but read all the labels. It says that it's in speech that people don't approve of it. You've put it in the dictionary. This is absolutely anathema.
What about anything?
What about which one?
Anything.
With the K on the end. That'll be our one and only question, by the way.
Cockney.
Is it?
Yes. And only anything and something. Very, very... What did the Oxford used to say about bloody? Common in the mouths of the working classes or something?
Only in working class use.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank Riley Sussex and Sue Butler very much for this afternoon.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.